Welcome, everybody, to the PFF College Football Podcast. I'm your host, PFF Zeph, coming at you live from my mom's basement here in Montreal, Quebec, Canada. And I am alongside, as always, Deontay Lee from beautiful and sunny San Diego, California. What's up, D?
I'm good, man. I hope that this doesn't depress you too much, but it was 85 degrees today. So, you know,
it was good
over here. Can't relate to that cold and wind that you got to deal with. Couldn't be me.
The weather is definitely changing. And speaking of the weather and changing, I don't know what I'm saying.
Once again, a killer weather intro from Zeph DeLina. Round of applause,
Segway King.
We have on the podcast, friends of the podcast, really, coming on for his second time, Mr. Benjamin Solak from the Draft Network. And making his PFF college football debut, Mr. Derek Klassen from RotoWire.
It was RotoWorld. No longer RotoWorld. It is NBC Sports Edge, which nobody I have talked to has gotten used to saying yet, and I'm not sure any of us ever will. And Football Outsiders.
He works for a real network, Seth.
He's working for an edge, man. Come on now.
Yeah, sorry, Derek. Me and Derek have known each other for a long time. We live parallel lives just across the country from each other. So the reason I wanted to have you guys on was to talk quarterbacks, because both of you have recently put out your manuscripts, your manifestos, your quarterback books, and from all the charting that both of you guys do, obviously me and Deontay have access to charting also, but we don't have to talk about that right now. So the first thing I want to ask both of you is, first is, how do you get into this? Like, how does your life lead you to charting quarterbacks? Sorry, and specifically charting college quarterbacks.
Yeah, it's a really good question, because you ask yourself it a lot when you're charting and you're like 400 attempts into Sam Ellinger and you're like, what am I doing here? I don't know, because it's a laborious process. But for me, it was the 2018 quarterback class. So I've been covering the draft for a year, maybe 2 years, not like too long. And that 2018 quarterback class was the most explosive. That was the Sam Darnold, Lamar Jackson, Josh Allen, Josh Rosen, Baker Mayfield group. Was the most explosive I've covered by a mile. And then for a lot of people, was the most explosive. Obviously, five quarterbacks end up going first round. That's crazy. And there were just so many narratives. How accurate was Josh Allen really? Completion percentage was so bad. Was that going to be able to change in the league? There was the Lamar Jackson conversation, which ranged from like, you know, he's not even a quarterback, to he's always leaving the pocket, to he can't throw outside of the numbers. And all those spectrum of Josh Rosen from the pocket, Baker Mayfield with RPOs and tight windows. There was just so much going on. And there weren't a lot of great resources with answers. There's a lot more now. Like, even just then, like 3 years ago, there weren't as many. And so
you guys
wanted
to ask, I'll give you, I have the data. So
yeah, you back in the day, you were in the Valley Shook, brother. All right. I didn't have the in for PFM Ultimate. And so, I don't even know if like we chatted then, but either way, regardless, I wanted to be able to try to give good answers to these questions. And so I was like, all right, I'm just going to watch the top quarterbacks, and I'm going to chart every passing attempt by these interesting ideas, and hopefully be able to say things like Josh Allen is X accurate, Lamar Jackson leaves the pocket Y times, and we'll solve football discourse. That didn't happen. But it, number one, it was helpful. I think it gave a good framework for talking about these guys. It's funny, the one person that helped me with the most was Sam Darnold, who didn't chart very well, and everybody was really gung-ho about him, and then obviously Darnold's career became what it became. But that it did give us good answers. And the other thing is, it really helped me start to learn like what questions to ask about evaluating and offenses. You know what I mean? Like, you just notice so many interesting things peripherally that it made me just better at evaluating. And so I decided every year I was going to do this. And now it's part of our yearly content, the Draft Network. I learn different things every year. I mean, I would say less, but like more interesting things, you know, you're kind of growing in that, whatever, but it's still a good exercise, because when you really just sit down and force yourself to analytically, algorithmically go through every passing attempt, you get, I think, a different perspective on these quarterbacks. It's cool.
Yeah, see, my journey into quarterback charting is a lot more like random and completely nonsense. Like, it wasn't like I saw this like this ideal quarterback class and was like, wow, I really need to like solve something here. I think I started in 2016 was the first class. And for anyone who has been on Twitter for a long time knows who Eric Stoner is. He was like charting. He had like his own template for charting these quarterbacks. And he was just like, he was charting like Matt Barkley or something like way, like from years previous. And he knew that I was interested in quarterbacks. And I think one day he was like, you know, if you're interested in like charting quarterbacks, just like take this and you can just use this. And I was like, huh, I don't know if I really care about charting quarterbacks like that, but I guess I'll try it. And then I did. I tweaked a couple of the stuff in there from the jump, and then I've changed some stuff a little bit over the years. But he basically just gave me a template, and I was like, well, I guess this is a good thing that I can just do. It feels like less of a good thing, like Ben said, when you get to the Nate Stanleys and people like that of the world. But I mean, yeah, I kind of just got like a template thrown into my lap, and it's kind of just become the thing that I do every year. And like to Ben's point, I think the best part about it is not necessarily like you get a charting profile and you're like, wow, I solved the problem. This is a thing. Like Justin Fields. I love Justin Fields, and I'm sure we'll get to that. He has my best charting profile ever. That doesn't like outright mean that he's the best quarterback I've ever seen. He's very good, but it's obviously like not it. That simple.
That's what I'm hearing.
He's close, but he's not outright better than Trevor Lawrence. But I think what's interesting about the charting, and like part of the reason why I do it is like, you'll see stuff like Trey Lance has some really awkward numbers in a lot of spots, and his accuracy is a little like a tick below a lot of the other guys. But if you look at his percentage of plays on third downs, like as a portion of his overall profile, it's significantly higher than a lot of these guys, which means that he's playing in these higher leverage situations. So yeah, throwing the ball is going to be a little bit tougher. So his numbers are probably not going to look as clean as guys like, you know, Justin Fields and Trevor Lawrence, who are consistently getting a lot more favorable situations than a guy like Lance was going to get, just in terms of the structure of the offense and stuff. So I think stuff like that is the value in the data, rather than just being like, oh, X player was a little bit more accurate, that means he's better.
I kind of want to open this question up to all of you guys, Seth included. Do you feel that this approach with charting is a little bit more amenable to the quarterback position or maybe offense in general? I know I bring this up because I know, Ben, the first time you put out CQ, I think I had DM'd you and just asked kind of like what that process was like, you know, what that whole undertaking was like, how you felt about it, you know, coming out of it when you had published it. So for each of you guys, I know all three of you have taken like a large interest in the quarterback position. Is charting something you think that's easier there than at other positions? What's the draw for you guys?
Yeah, and when Deontay DM'd me, I did not know he was like a top flight high school DC. So I was like, I know stuff. And then later I learned, I was like, frick, I should not have been as confident in things that I said. But the reason that I think quarterback charting is interesting to me, like from the top, like A, is because my job is to create content and people care about quarterbacks, right? So like I come at it from a different perspective there, which is like, that's what I'm churning out, especially because like I'm covering the draft year round. But the second thing in terms of like more nuance with the league is that there's a lot more resources and a lot more ability to understand quarterbacks' decisions in real time. First reason is because the camera's on them. You know what I mean? I wish I could tell you a safety's decisions in real time. If he plays for a certain school, I won't have his all 22. I couldn't even do it if I wanted to. You know what I mean? He's not, I can't see him. And then because there's so many more resources for quarterback play, you find playbooks and you find clinics, and you find analogous offenses. It's a lot easier for me if I don't understand what a quarterback's doing to go through and try to piece together, all right, what decision is he making? Because at the end of the day, what charting is it's either features of a play or it's decisions, right? It's like, you know, I'm charting like first read or beyond first read. Like, is he scrambling? Is this pressure his fault or the offensive line's fault? Well, it depends on what these guys are seeing. And so you need to have a wide pool of information to be able to pull from to make those claims with your chest, at least as strongly as you can. Whereas like, I think that, you know, somebody could chart edges really well, right? Like Brandon Thorne did like his, you know, his true sack production where he's like, I'm an offensive line guy, so I'm going to chart all these rush moves because I know how to distinguish them, and I'm going to chart their quality because I've seen enough film and I've done enough coaching work to understand that. And that is valuable, but you have to have the depth, like the pool to reach into in order to be able to chart with your chest, which is now a thing I'm going to say all the time. So I kind of like it.
I think it also depends a little bit on like what you're charting. So like with let's take linebacker play, for example. I think some of the only things that you would want to chart for a linebacker is like, did he fit the right gap? And that is going to take a little bit higher knowledge than just being like, did a quarterback throw an accurate ball? Like there's like, to me, like I don't necessarily chart a lot of process things in the sense of like, I personally don't do like first read, second read, third read, or like, is it a right decision or is it a bad decision? I just chart if it was an accurate pass, like, did it require some sort of adjustment, which obviously has like some degree of subjectivity to it, but it's not like a, I needed to know the exact assignment on this play. It obviously helps in certain situations, to Ben's point. But it's a little bit more like you're just looking for simpler data points in a sense. Whereas like to Ben's point, like if you're looking for a safety play or linebacker play, a lot more stuff like that, you kind of do need to have a higher ground for your knowledge, and it can be a lot harder to find that, you know, some of the things that you're looking for. And also like for defense in particular, as opposed to charting an offensive player or a quarterback, like a lot of defensive stuff is just a lot more ambiguous, and I think it would just be really hard to chart to like really get things down to a super granular level like that.
I think for me the best positions are the one-on-one positions to chart, in terms of leaving out any as much subjectivity as we can. And that's really O-line, D-line, because it's really wins and losses. And you can even get into receiver DB.
Right, for like wins Matt Harmon reception too. Perception stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right. So you can get into that for sure. But for sure, the O-line, D-line, because you don't have to get into the granular aspects of what move it was. Did he kick set enough? You know what I mean? Did he get too wide? And then that's why, you know, like we don't have to get into that granular stuff. We can just say, hey, did he win the rep or not? Or did he win the rep by a lot, a little? Or they lose it by a lot or a little, I guess, right? That's kind of what's PFF grading. That's why I think PFF does the best job when it comes to O-line and D-line for sure. I think that's our top most, you know, our best work is with O-line, D-line stuff, in my opinion. And then I think with quarterback play, you are getting a little more subjective. Obviously, I don't have to worry about finding all 22 of college teams. I can just come on PFF Ultimate and I have it there.
Bring us on here just to make fun of us? Is that how the rest of the show is going to go?
Like, I'm going to bring on these poor quarterback charters, these plebeians, these members of the proletariat.
We said this podcast. We could not watch Oregon State versus Stanford, man. And I'm sure if you wanted to, for whatever deranged reason, you could have.
Yes, I think that's Oregon better for your own mental health that you can't watch.
Probably. especially, yeah. I just think that like there is some positions that are less subjective that are that I think you can chart. That I think really anyone can chart, because like I said, it's just wins and losses. And then I think with quarterback play, I do think you can do it in both ways, right? You can do it kind of the way that Ben does it with more. And I was going to ask you this question, both of you, where it's more, you know, we can get into first read, second read, third read, and be a little bit more subjective. Or you can have as objective a process as you can, like Derek is saying, was this ball thrown accurately and was it not? And the thing is, you end up, so I always think like you kind of end up in the same spots a lot of times, because at the end of the day, we are looking, process is important, obviously, but when we're looking back on charting, it's all about the results, like what happened on the field, whether that was a good play or a bad play, we think is a good play or a bad play, regardless, the process was correct or it was incorrect. So then my question is like, what are you guys charting? Like, what are the different things that you guys are charting?
One, it's a lot. I think that's going to be the answer for both me or Ben. I think it just kind of depends on what you're looking for. For me, I do obviously like, you know, just ball placement. And then I kind of adjust for whether the receiver had to adjust to the ball, which is not going to be in every situation, because there's actually throws where the quarterback has to force the receiver to make an adjustment because of just, you know, where a defender is or whatever. And that's a good throw. So I don't actually count that as an adjustment, because the receiver would be dead or on a medical card if he didn't throw it that way. So I think stuff like that is important to keep track of, but then I'll also chart like pressures, explosive plays, how often they're getting their passes defended by defenders. You know, you can kind of gauge how aggressive a quarterback is, which is not always a bad thing. Trevor Lawrence is, for me, was extremely high. I think the second highest in the class. That's not to say Trevor's an idiot. He just likes to press his luck a little bit because he's obviously good enough. And then obviously like the throwing distances outside the pocket, inside the pocket, play action, RPO stuff, empty. And then I do like to chart like the number of rushers, so you can kind of get a gauge for how often a guy is getting blitzed, versus how often teams are just rushing three and being like, you know, we don't really respect him. We're just going to do this. Just stuff like that. Which I think you still kind of have to take with a grain of salt too. Cause like Trey Lance had the highest average pass rushers against him, but it's also like, yeah, they run like max protect a ton. So of course guys are just going to add rushers on, and you kind of still have to keep that in your mind when you're scrolling through the data. But that's probably just like the weirdest thing that I add on, but I don't think I have anything too crazy. I know Ben likes to chart first read, second read, stuff like that. But for me personally, I feel like the data I'm going to get on something like that is going to be too muddy for me to get what I want out of it. Like if I have, you know, if I chart a guy and he has 8 throws that are past his first read, 11 to 15 yards, that is a honestly meaningless sample to me. Like that's right. Just not a high enough amount of throws to tell me anything, because it could just be completely random. So that's personally why I don't do it, which is not to say that what Ben is doing is wrong.
Ben, your rebuttal. Ben, can you respond? Ben, please respond.
Derek's 100% right. Yes, because the number one thing people go to, especially this year with the whole Justin Fields thing, but every year, is the beyond first read thing. And I always want to be like, I'm still putting this out because it's interesting and conversations, but we should take that with a big grain of salt. There's about, I chart first read and beyond. I don't do like first, second, third, and whatever. And just the question of like, what is a first read is already just baked in trouble, yep. Right?
Answer the question, Ben. What is a first read?
60 seconds to respond. No, I was DMing with Seth about this, where it's like, what does a quarterback read? Is it purely ordinal progressions? My number one here is going to be this, the flag route, and then I'm going to work down to the hitch. And if that's not open, right? Like mesh sit wheel, everybody loves to put it 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. It's not 1, 2, 3, 4. It's not what happens. You read the wheel in a second. Is this capped or is it uncapped? And then if it's not, you're moving. So are we reading
in the building?
Are we reading area? Are we reading defenders? Right? Like, so what, like for me, what I always look for is if a quarterback is throwing, like he gets to the top of his drop, he hitches and he throws, 99% of the time, that's going to be a first read throw. Like if he threw that in rhythm, even if he moved his eyes, right? Like, oh, I'm pulling the safety over here. I'm really throwing over there. He didn't read that. That was not a read. That was just in your drop to relocate a defender. You know what I mean? And that becomes a splitting of hairs. So it's a difficult thing to chart. And so whenever I do the first read, I'm a lot more interested in things like, what does his depth of target become? What does his completion percentage become? Are we going first read and we're working to our check down? Are we doing first read or we're going to a backside dig? Because if your offense is giving you a running back swing, I don't think they trust you as much as the offense that's given that guy a backside dig. Some of that is structural. And that's the thing about charting college quarterbacks. Like I also do number of rushers, and I just started doing it this year for college players. And my sense, I did a number of rushes for NFL players last year, and I got the sense of like, oh, this means something. Some quarterbacks teams are blitzing. Some quarterbacks teams are dropping 8. In college, I got the sense of like, oh, the JMU defense blitzes. So they did it against Trey Lance, and Trey Lance was able to break some really big freaking runs, and maybe they shouldn't have done that as much. You know, colleges, and I don't know, like Deontay and Seth, probably you guys can speak to this more, tend to kind of just, I think, be what they are at the defensive level, as opposed to like changing game plans week in, week out, at least at a middle average level. So I do first read and beyond. I do drop back type I added this year. So standard drop back, RPO and play action, alignment under center and shotgun. I do middle of the field open and closed, which again, at the college level, that gets really noisy because of how freaking far apart the hashes are. So that like, I don't tag that for like a decent percentage of my plays, because I just can't say with certainty, you know what I mean? So that's much more so like an information finding effort than it is like, this means something. You know what I mean? In and out of the pocket. Are you throwing from a clean platform? Are you throwing on the move? Are you throwing from an adjusted platform? You got somebody in your lap. You're about to get hit. You got to step into the bucket. Pressured. I do clean window and tight window, open window, and tight window, which I think is a fun one. And then yeah, results, you know what I mean? Completion, interceptable, pass breakup, defensive pass interference, and then accuracy and placement. And what Derek does in terms of, you know, was it accurate data force and adjustment is so important. That's where I go back to the pool of resources. You know what I mean? Like quarterbacks are taught, like if you're throwing into the red zone, this ball is going to be face mask or higher. Right. And that's that Ryan Day used that frame, that terminology for Justin Fields red zone throws. So if you're charting adjustment, like, oh no, he made the receiver jump. He tried to, that ball has got to be high. If we throw high in the red zone, it sails. Guess what? There's no safety behind the end line. We're not worried about an interception. We throw low. That's a batted pass. That's pointed into the air. That's a tip drill. That's a pick. So in the red zone, we throw face mask or higher, but if we're throwing near pylon to Chris Olave against Clemson on a squirrel route, that's got to be low and outside because we're throwing it to the bottom. So like that wide receiver adjustment is so important to charting accuracy because you have to know what a quarterback's being coached to do on each particular throw. So I chart accuracy. Was it catchable? Yes or no. And then I chart ball placement. Was this where you should have put it relative to the coverage, relative to the context? Are you protecting your receiver from hits, so on and so forth?
Right. That's why I like my adjustment thing. Whenever I write it down anywhere, like for a column or whatever, I say that specifically that it is an unnecessary adjustment force,
right?
Because there's going to be throws, like I said, where you have to throw low so your guy doesn't get by a safety, or yeah, you're throwing to the back of the end zone and you have to throw high because you're coached to do that. And that's the only place that the ball can go. So yeah, like when I chart adjustments specifically, it's unnecessary because yeah, there's going to be, I mean, Deshaun Watson, I think coming out was a really good example of this where like he threw a lot of passes that were technically accurate, but looked like they were a little bit wonky because he was really pressing his luck in the sense of like pressing tight windows, but he was just so good at throwing around those defenders and understanding where the space was that it looked like he was inaccurate, but he was actually just hitting windows that really didn't exist for not Deshaun Watson quarterbacks.
The thing that's been really interesting to me about this first read conversation is something that I think you guys are touching on, not just about first reads, but just about charting in general. And that's what we're using the data for, how we're contextualizing it, where it's important and where it's not, right? Like, it's not enough just to chart quarterbacks and think like, all right, well, then we're just going to work off of sample size. And if I get a sample size I like, then we'll use this almost as, you know, a statement of fact, right? Everything that you chart has to have some kind of purpose. And that's really what's been interesting to me, looking at people who maybe don't approach charting or don't approach their contextualization of charting in that same way. So like with that in mind, is there anything that you guys have noticed throughout your time in charting where maybe you don't think you solved, you know, evaluating the position, but there are certain trends where it's like, okay, if he ticks off X, Y, and Z, I know that his ceiling might be here. But if he does this, this, and that, I think that it might be here, or his floor is here, or I know that if you can't meet this threshold, you're not a pro level quarterback or whatever the case may be.
For me personally, it's the threshold thing is like the easiest way to break down the data. Cause like for me, I think my threshold is around like 70-ish%. And I've tweeted this before, like I've probably been a little bit more lenient on accuracy as the years have gone on. So I probably need to adjust that. By class.
I'm getting more strict. I'm getting
really, that's interesting. But anyway, yeah, I think it's like, I would have to adjust exactly what it is, but it's probably around 70% for any given class. Guys who are under that tend to not be very good. There are a couple of hits. There was like Josh Allen has been good. Dak Prescott has been good. And almost everyone under like that kind of random threshold that is, I didn't even set that intentionally. That's kind of just how the data has bared out. Everyone under that is not very good. Not necessarily everyone over that is good, but it at least gives you a sense of like, okay, if this guy's under it, he's not as good as I thought, and it's probably not worth spending my time on him.
Is that your catchable rate, Derek?
Yeah.
Okay, well, like, I don't think I've ever had a quarterback come in under 70% for catchable for me. So I've probably started too lenient, and I'm working my way down.
Okay.
I think I had, like, Brandon Silvers and Tanner Lee below that, but that was back when I was charting those guys. I don't chart those guys anymore.
Because I had the issue initially where I was, like, barely getting anyone over 70. So.
Right. So, and this is a good point, right? It's just, like, whether or not a ball is catchable is up for debate. So when we're getting into like, you know, is this an adjusted platform, tight window, da da da, like it's all a nightmare. To answer your question, Deontay, I have, in my experience, when I chart the placement for like in pocket and out of pocket and like clear window and tight window and pressured and unpressured. And in my experience, quarterbacks who in all of those contexts, when things get muddy, have big drops in their accuracy and placement, those guys struggle. And the big one was Josh Rosen. Rosen's profile looked great if you just ignored when bad things happen to the UCLA offense, which we shouldn't do when we're evaluating. But when he was forced beyond his first read outside of his pocket, throwing on the move, throwing from adjusted platforms, there were big drop-offs in accuracy and in placement. The same thing happened to Dwayne Haskins in the following year. And then it happened to Tua. And, you know, the book's not written on Tua, but the rookie season had its lumps. He certainly wasn't as good as he looked at Alabama, which this makes sense given what we're talking. It's going to be muddier in the league, and you're not as used to that. The player for that this year is Mac Jones, emphatically. Mac Jones has bigger deltas in terms of clean versus, you know, move platform, clear window versus tight window, than any quarterback I've ever charted. You can put it another way. I've never charted a quarterback for whom it was as easy as it was for Mac Jones, includes Joe Burrow. So when you talk about jumping to the NFL, if Mac ends up in not San Francisco, how easy are we going to be able to keep this for him? And what's that going to look like when it's not? The framework I've ended up talking about here is quarterbacks need to have answers for problems. You know what I mean? You've got to be able to respond to different questions. You got to be able to respond to different impetus. You can only keep a guy so clean and so easy. Like even Shanahan and McVay came up against the ceiling of this recently. And so I don't have an accuracy score that stood out to me, or like, if he's doing this, then that's good. You know, how often he's getting beyond his first read, whatever, but you better be able to at least throwing on the move or throwing into tight windows, have something where you have an answer to one of these problems. Otherwise, it seems you're going to be like lost in the water when you get to the NFL.
Was there anything, continuing the trends talk, was there anything like that you saw offensively or defensively, maybe more schematically, like zooming out a bit, that has either something that just, you know, that popped out to you, or even something that now that you've been doing it for a few years has changed and therefore you have to change what you're looking at with the quarterback? Does that make sense? So like, you know, all of a sudden everyone's running, you talked about before, number of rushers. I mean, dude, like the whole world is rushing three, dropping eight, playing with three high safety. It changes. Everything has changed. Mm-hmm. For me, looking at it from like just a scheme perspective, but have things changed from, because of that, into the charting perspective, the quarterback perspective?
I mean, I think for me, particularly the guys that are at the best schools, Mac Jones, even Kyle Trask, like a lot of the guys who are in those just absolutely peak offenses, I think perfection is such a dumb word, but the perfection of all of these RPOs, especially the ones like the glances and stuff that are just, is free money. And like when I started doing this in 2016, and this might be why I've gotten a little bit consistently more lenient on accuracy, or my accuracy numbers have gone up, is like every team in the country is getting good at these because it's so freaking easy, especially at the college level with the way that the rules are. And that was not necessarily true 5 years ago when I started in 2016. It was there a little bit and some teams were good at it, but now it's like if you're not good at it, you're like hamstringing your quarterback and you're putting them in a more difficult position. Like Kellen Mond is in a way a good example of this, where like that Texas A&M offense actually asked him to do a lot of NFL stuff, but I'm sure if they simplified it and got good at the RPO stuff, you know, if they were like a Dan Mullen offense, his numbers probably would have looked better because the game would have just been simpler for him. And so I think, honestly, a lot of the guys who are actually tasked with playing football, it's a little harder for them to test as well in my numbers than it is for, you know, the guys like Mac Jones. Like, I'm not sure Mac Jones is great, but man, it would have been really, really hard to not look good in my numbers.
Yeah, I'm impressed by the way that we often see innovation trickle up high school to college to NFL. And now I think with that Shanahan boot action, play action system, you're seeing a little bit of a trickle down. Not to say that college didn't know about it. Everybody knew about it. Things have been around forever. But the way that it can, as RPOs do, give you ease of target, but get it a little bit deeper down the field. You know, you're going to get a hard sell with those offensive linemen moving. I think about that Steve Sarkisian clinic where he's like, we go play pass and we pull a guard, because when we pull a guard, linebackers have no choice. You know what I mean? You've got to respect that. And that's going to be our hard sell. So that understanding of how play action matters, not every team in college can go for that because you need to have offensive line talent. But a lot of the teams that have offensive line talent have quarterback talent because they're just recruiting good everywhere. And so now, all right, I'm Zach Wilson. I'm already good at this. I'm Justin Fields. I'm already good at this. and now we're going to run a little boot action. You know what I mean? We're going to run a 7-step drop. That's why I added drop depth and alignment, quarterback alignment this year. And then I was 3 quarterbacks in and I was like, I need to start adding a tag for boots, especially with the way that once the Niners traded up, I was like, I can't not, I have to know how many times these guys boot. And if they're throwing on the move in structure, out of structure, because that's a big deal. So then I had to go and add a column and it was a total nightmare, but it was worth it. That offense now showing college teams, hey, if you have an offensive line that can pull this off, and a quarterback who's comfortable on a naked and making good decisions, this is another, you know, this is easy access when you want it. That's a very big deal because it's going to exclusively make the good teams better and probably not like the RPO be as beneficial as the middle tier teams as well.
I will push back a little bit. It's maybe just one example. And I think about Louisville 2 years ago, so not this past season, mm-hmm. where they kind of faltered a little bit. But in Satterfield's first year there, you know, they were a pistol outside zone boot team. And
we thought Malik Cunningham was going to be a prospect.
Yeah, that's a whole nother story.
I was right there with you. But no, that is a good team. I didn't think about that. And certainly that's why I say like teams at the college level have known about outside zone. I think that I was particularly thinking of Wilson and the jump that he's enjoyed as a prospect, which as you were the one who wrote the OG piece where it was like, hey, if this offense is doing this for NFL quarterbacks, this guy wasn't much of a prospect last year. You know, that's a legitimate thing that I think we have to contend with evaluating and charting, as well as understanding how much is that system, you know, under center wide zone boot affecting things like depth of target and downfield accuracy and so on and so forth.
If you are into the NFL draft, which I'm sure you are, you can go to PFF.com on April 29th. That is the night of the draft at 7 p.m. And you can watch the PFF draft show instead of watching those other networks. You can come kick it with us at the PFF headquarters in Cincinnati, Ohio. Thursday, April 29th, we're covering every round. So Friday, Saturday also, and then a Sunday recap show at noon. Chris Collinsworth is going to be there. A bunch of draft analysts are going to be there and special guest appearances as well. So tune in pff.com, 7 p.m. Thursday, April 29th. In these uncertain times, life is full of questions like, when should I start thinking about life insurance? But however difficult these questions may be, Western and Southern can help you answer them. Backed by over 130 years of experience, together we can look ahead to leave the unknown behind. Western and Southern Financial Group, life insurance, retirement, and investments. Compensated endorser, products issued by member companies of Western and Southern Financial Group, Cincinnati, Ohio.
That makes a lot of sense. I think that, you know, for me, somebody who does not do the chart, that does not live in the charting world, especially with quarterbacks, one thing that I know, you know, zooming out, is just how often people get schemed to just be absolutely butt naked open. And that's something that both of you guys have touched on. So whether it's off of play action, whether it's RPOs, like you mentioned, you know, we've just moved into an era, particularly in college football, where the spread was used as a function to create space to run the ball in the last decade. And now we're just seeing passing offense really catch up and figure out how to create the same kind of space in the passing game as running the ball becomes more difficult now out of the spread. So
Deontay, as a defense man, are you like, yo, we got to move this offensive line one yard. Like, this is too much.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Like, that is actually
at first just start calling the penalty itself, but also moving close to the line of scrimmage.
Absolutely. Because to me, I mean, and I'm going to try not to go in my defensive coach soapbox, it just does not, hold any water to me logically to allow offensive linemen to work 3 to 5 yards down the field without it being a penalty. That's not football. Nobody can convince
me that is not charting football. Jamie Newman was just an exercise in absurdity. Like, the pocket isn't real. All right.
Right.
His throwing base isn't real. Like, every like conception that I have for charting is like, I can't even know what this is. This is not passing. Like, I don't even know how you watch it as a scout and go like, this will translate. He's playing like point guard. Like, it's not real. It's amazing.
Well, and what's funny about Newman is, so for me, in specifically the 11 to 15 yard area, he was actually like atrocious. But I think part of that is because they would do this, you know, RPO glance stuff, but in normal RPO glance or whatever, you'll like kind of do the mesh like pretty, you know, at a decent speed, and you'll be able to like set yourself and throw the ball. Because they will sometimes do it after the like the super long hold stuff that they do. Newman, like by the time he actually gets to get the ball out, he has five defenders in his lap, and it's like an impossible throw. And so he's actually like, he specifically is actually not getting it as easy as some of these other guys. I still don't think he's very good, but I think that's part of why his numbers looked as awkward as they did, because the offense, yeah, like Ben said, it's like, it's fake, and it's kind of hard to like square that with the numbers sometimes.
Mm-hmm. I will say though, with the Wake Forest offense, just specifically, I mean, he produced well. Sam Hartman last year produced very well. He's coming back again for another year. It's weird. It's fucking weird.
I love it.
But I love
think it should be illegal. But I love it.
So this conversation about scheme, I think, actually kind of dovetails perfectly into the next question I want to ask. And that's about, you know, quarterback narratives as they stand now, as guys go from college to pro. You know, we've heard the air raid quarterbacks won't last in the NFL. We've heard that, you know, you got to play in a 21 personnel offense to really be able to understand. And then we have, you know, our infatuations with the Tom Brady's, the Peyton Manning's, guys who can check the protection and change the concept at the line of scrimmage. And, you know, I'm just wondering for you guys, are there any narratives that you guys think that hold true presently? Any new narratives that have developed that you think maybe have gone kind of under examined, or something that maybe has popped up in your own charting where you think like nobody's talking about this at all? And I think that this is something that we can use anecdotally that carries and has some basis in what I'm seeing statistically.
How irresponsible should I be?
Oh God, please. I gotta clip it. I'm let me record. I'm gonna clip it right on Twitter.
How irresponsible can you get?
Quarterback processing outside of the pocket is more interesting and impressive than quarterback processing inside the pocket. We always think about processing. We always think about processing as inside the pocket, right? And it's
this
like,
is
all
a
right.
Fact. Everybody listen closely. This is
you
a
have,
fact.
You have a script, you know what I mean? Like and obviously like it's not like every quarterback in the world is good. So it's not like it's an easy script. And defense's job is to make that script occluded. Like, oh, if it's middle of the field closed, I'll read this side of the field, and open, I'll read that side of the field. Well, we're going to rotate a safety. Screw you. Like, you know, there's a game here. Obviously we know this to be true, but there's generally a script to follow, and there's checkdowns and there's releases and there's a construct that you have worked in and you have put on the chalkboard. And when you go out and you're running against air, you can work it on your feet and you can work it with your body framing, and you can get this entire thing to some degree automated, where you understand when you're under center what's about to happen in the next 1.5 seconds. If A happens, I'll do B. If C happens, I'll do D. If you got to break the pocket, If the defense won the rep, if your offensive lineman lost early, if they had you covered up, you've got to break the pocket. There are scramble rules, and the rules are, okay, if you're already downfield on that side, you just kind of keep going that way. And if you're across the field, you go across the field and kind of get a little bit deeper. It's just like, hey, generally space yourselves out. This guy's going to make a decision. He's going to make a play, and he's going to be under duress when it happens. Body's flying. He's going to be in motion. He's going to be in movement instead of being static. He's going to be up against the sideline, and the clock is going to be ticking. It's going to be late in the down, so he's held the ball for a while. His internal clock is going. It's a lot more stress in that moment. With the way that bodies are flying around, you really have to have impressive arm talent and then an understanding of your arm talent to know what throws you can make. And so, like when I chart first read and beyond, one of the things that gets hazy in that data is if a quarterback breaks the pocket for whatever reason, he's at this point beyond his first read technically. And so how much is that get folded into processing? Well, over time, quarterbacks who are good throwing beyond their first read on the move, Joe Burrow and Justin Herbert, two recent examples who are both quite good at that, went on and did that in the league. On the fly, unscripted, outside of the pocket processing, to me, is a very valuable trait. And it usually we talk about quarterbacks as if you're breaking the pockets because you don't know how to read the field. Maybe sometimes there's some truth to that. Guys don't want to be in the pocket, whatever. But boy, when you're outside of the pocket, you read the field and you read it in live time with live bullets. So to me, that's a very big deal.
I think the idea that it seems like some people now like cling on to like, oh, well, this guy is so great outside the pocket. That's cool. But that means he must have done something wrong inside the pocket. And to your point, like, I think that's BS. Like, there's obviously going to be situations.
A couple people didn't watch Auburn's offense last night. <That's>
not... Like, there's obviously going to be situations where the quarterback is at fault. And I think like Zach Wilson's a good example of this. He will just say, screw it and go do whatever right. he wants. And maybe you don't want him to do that as much. But like, I think, especially when you get to the NFL, like these coordinators are good, man. These pass rushers are good. These cornerbacks are good. Like they're going to force you into bad plays, even if you did nothing wrong. And I think especially now you have to have, like Ben said, you have to have these answers. I think like, especially in today's NFL, it's more that you have to get to a baseline with the in the pocket stuff and then be pretty good right. at the outside of the pocket stuff. Whereas maybe especially before the CBA in 2011, like 10, 15 years ago, it was probably a little bit more the opposite, where you had to be this guy who was really sharp inside the pocket. And then you had to be able to just do enough outside the pocket to keep the offense doing what it wants to do.
But, I don't want to soapbox too long, but Derek's point is perfect in the sense of like, eventually at some point in January, somebody's going to make you win outside of structure. Right. And so that's like, all right, am I drafting a quarterback to get to January or to win in January? Sometimes some teams is just like get to January. You know what I mean? Like Carolina Panthers, I'm just trying to get to January and then we're going to deal with the rest later. But once it's time to start winning the playoffs, some defense is going to be good. It's going to get you outside of structure and they're going to do it regularly and they're going to make it a nightmare. And you've got to be able to deal with that. And that idea, like we've shifted this meta, as Derek's talking about, to being like quarterback creation outside of the pocket is critical. It's so important. In the pocket is important. Outside of the pocket is important. It all boils back down to like, you have to have answers to the test. You've got to be able to answer questions and in terms of like the cleanness and the muddiness. And so if I'm looking for like a guy, like capital G, the first thing I want is like, what are you able to do for me outside of the pocket? Because at this stage, Shanahan has a quote about this. I think it was a few years ago that he said it, but he was basically like, offenses are so good at this point that I can get a guy and I can put him in there and we can go win some games. We can throw the ball around the yard, whatever. If I can go get an elite player, elite arm is what I think he called it. Like he said, there's like seven elite arms in the league at any given time. So I can go get one of the seven elite arms. I don't give a hoot about pocket management. I don't like, it's nice, but like, if I get an elite arm, then we'll solve every problem after I get him in the building. But that right there is what wins me games in January.
I think specifically talking about winning a game in January, I think back to the Bills Colts playoff game where Josh Allen, who was not great outside the pocket, maybe he was making the right decisions in years past, but he couldn't get the ball to his receivers, where all of a sudden, you know, we saw this past year. And again, the Colts game in the playoffs, like you're talking about, comes to mind because they were doing a pretty good job of dropping deep, dropping seven, sometimes eight, I think mostly seven though. But dropping deep enough that he couldn't get to the spots that he wants to get to with that live arm from the pocket. And now he's got to get outside the pocket and they couldn't stop him. Once he got outside right. the pocket, he's finding digs on the side.
And that game is a great example too, because he was trying to stay in the pocket for as long as possible. And we were all like, Josh, like freak out, leave. And he was like, no, I'm going to stay. And then eventually Danico Autry would try to chase him down. Like, all right, this isn't going to work. And then, you know, he'd go make a play. But right. That's exactly Derek's point.
Yeah, and I think the reason why, and this is to your point, Benny, you've been kind of hammering on this, and I kind of want to reinforce it, is because those outside of structure, outside of pocket plays, A, you're much more likely to get contact on the quarterback. So you're going to find out what kind of quarterback he is when there's ugliness around his feet, right? Are there guys chasing him down? Is he going to be able to set his feet or his shoulder, or his shoulders pointed the way they're supposed to be? Are his eyes where they're supposed to be? You know, you can figure out all of that stuff from both a mechanical and an outcome standpoint. Two, you're going to see tight window throws, because that's usually what you're going to get outside of the pocket, because you're really not going to have the kind of time to set your feet and bomb these pro day throws where guys are floating backwards and just unleashing these 65-yard bombs on post. That's not really how that works in the game. So you are going to have to make those decisions on, okay, here comes this dig from the backside that I would probably never get to in my progression usually, but that's all I've got right now. Do I think that I can squeeze this in before the safety comes and knocks his head off? And then that gets into something that's very valuable to me, which is your athletic ability. because while it is valuable to be able to fit the ball into that window, every once in a while, the answer is I have to be my own check down as a quarterback. You know, it's not there, or the throw that I really want might be there, but I can't risk this, right? We're on the plus 35. The turnover here is going to kill us. You know what I'm saying? Or we haven't scored in a while. I've got another down to play with. Let me just take the 6.5 yards I can get out of bounds, and we'll live to fight another down. And that's part of the evolution of quarterback, you know, is being able to make those decisions outside of structure. And that, again, is a break from, I think, some of the adoration that we've had for more of the statue type guys who are very good at checking everything at the line of scrimmage. I'm going to take my snap. You know, I always think about Drew Brees for this because he's so good at it. It's just getting the ball out so fast that pass rush is almost a negligible factor. That's not really how it works for most guys in the NFL, especially if you're young. Maybe if you're at the top 0.05% of quarterbacks, you can get a good enough understanding and spend enough time in a system to where you do become computer-like. But at the end of the day, it's going to be about when everything goes to hell, who are you as a quarterback? What decisions do you make? Can you protect the ball? And can you still be explosive, right? It's easy to be explosive when you know, hey, I'm checking the single high. I know I've got a fade right here for my X receiver. The second I see the safety spin, I'm just going to let it go. And we're either getting 35 yards or it's an incompletion. No skin off my bones. You know what I'm saying? So that's kind of where that's kind of the way that I've always looked at it.
The problem is that to get to the point where you're talking about where you can get balls off before pass rushers get there, like you said, to be Drew Brees or whoever, one of these top quarterbacks, like you got to take some lumps early. And lumps, maybe not necessarily taking hits, but lumps being wrong. I've said this before, like you're going to be wrong. You're going to think the defense is doing something and they're not going to be doing that. And you're going to be wrong. And you're going to be holding onto the football because you thought someone was supposed to be open and he's not, or you're going to get a free rusher in your face right off the bat. And you're going to have to, make a play. I know that's that's such a cliche, but you know, if you're going to be wrong and early in your NFL career, you will be wrong. You're going to have to make a play. So in order to even think about getting to, like in today's NFL, in order to even think about getting to the point where you played in the league for 5+ years, 10 plus years, and you just get it. You've seen everything. Everything's coming quickly. You got to be able to escape. You got to be able to make plays outside the pocket. And it's all the stuff that we're talking about.
Right. Basically, to become Drew Brees, you have to have the first few seasons of Drew Brees' career and then, you know, level out. And the idea is now you're not getting that amount of patience.
Yeah.
Pass rushers are smarter. Coverage is better. And we know with adjusted practice time, you need even more than the first few years of Drew Brees' career to kind of level that all out. I didn't want to have any Drew Brees heresy on the podcast. I feel like that was fair.
I'm over. I'm done.
Oh, are you? Yeah. Okay. Come on.
We'll see how it feels when $140 million Taysom Hill is a guy.
I'm not sure even I would wish that upon stuff. But I think this is why like the Mac Jones thing is so interesting, right? Is because the pushback on, you know, when people like me or Ben or really all of us, I think, say something like, Mac Jones is pretty good at a lot of this clean inside the pocket stuff. When it breaks down, he's not that good. People will just say, oh, well, look at Tom Brady now. He just won the Super Bowl. Look at Drew Brees. Look at Philip Rivers even. But it's like, one, like you guys said, they had this depth of knowledge that they've been able to build up for, I mean, close to two decades for really all of these guys. But also, like, those guys had significantly stronger arms when they were younger and could do a lot of different things than a guy like Mac Jones can do right now, I think, which is why when people – like they were able to get away with different things and learn different things when they were younger. And Mac Jones, like when he gets into the league, is not going to have that margin of error. Like he's going to have to be current day Philip Rivers by year two. I'm sorry, but that's not going to happen no matter how much you like him. Like that's just not possible.
He's a football genius was what he was recently called by a source. So I don't know. Football genius. Which like if Mac's going to be successful, it's going to be because that. Like
it has to be.
Right.
Like, and you can't get there that fast. It's not possible.
Right. And that's the work that you have to do with him, like speaking to him and putting him on the board and so on and so forth and talking to you guys. Because the idea, and people love to do this, like, oh, he's a great processor, great anticipation, great decision maker. Alabama offense. I watched 4 games and then I could have, the 5th game, I could have told you where every single throw was going. You know what I mean? Yep. That you don't, it's everybody's open. They're all nuts. The protection is unbelievable. And Sarkisian's just running 20 yard crossers in 12 different directions. It's impossible. I don't know how you watch that film without any context, which we don't have and NFL teams do, and say like Jones is this once in a class, once every few class processors, fine processor. I can't get myself there. And so if teams can, and they're right, that's how Jones will be successful. It'll be right. He's just really, really good mentally. Not a bet that with the information I have, I'd be willing to make.
Right. I mean, I think that's the way to get put it, is that with the information that we have here, it's just an insane bet to make. Because I mean, those guys just don't, it's harder to develop those type of guys in the NFL. One, and like you said, like with the way that the offense constructed, it's very hard to make a clear bet that this guy is a special processor. And this is why I think it's so frustrating that he gets compared to Burrow. And I think what you touched on a little bit with your charting kind of leans into this. Yeah, like it's not close, but like the LSU offense,
Seth didn't take the bait on Drew Brees, but he took it on Burrow right away. Like, jumped into his defense.
We had to hit both just to make sure to see if we could get him. But like that LSU offense asked Burrow to do a lot more. They were very good, had a lot of talent, and they were obviously getting guys open. But like Burrow had to play quarterback, and like they did a lot of stuff from empty that was not easy to do. And I think it was a lot easier to see how Burrow's mental stuff would immediately translate to the NFL. And Burrow was very good outside the pocket. He was very good at making plays with his legs. He's not Lamar Jackson, sure, but like he was very good at making clean platforms for himself when they were not there. Mac Jones is not very good at that. So it's hard to imagine that he's going to get even the amount of chances to become this type of player that Joe Burrow is going to get.
All right, let me spend the next 65 minutes talking about Joe Burrow and the 2019 offense. No, I agree. I mean, I asked this question on Twitter like a year ago, I think. And I was like, hey, you're a high school OC. What are you taking from the LSU offense? Or you're a college OC or whatever. Like, what are you taking from the LSU offense? And not a lot of people can really like give you a good answer for that.
You're just relying on a kid who can play out of empty for 20% of the snaps. Right. Are you kidding me?
Get
somebody who's 5 years older than everybody else he's playing against.
That's the here we go.
get a quarterback who's older than me playing college football. So I think for me, and then you saw all the LSU, I don't have the rate off the top of my head, but I do know that they led the country in unblocked pressures allowed last season. Now they played 15 games, so that does skew it a bit. Like I said, I don't have the rate, but like Joe Burrow, like we're gonna get the PFF grades here, but Joe Burrow was like a 75 PFF passer against unblocked pressure, which is like this is like stupid. You're not supposed to be that good. Mm-hmm. So I think a lot of it was on Joe Burrow to be super accurate. Again, did they get people open? Yeah, of course. They have five-star receivers all across the board. Did they have the future, almost, in my book, the offensive rookie of the year in the NFL in 2020? Yeah, like it helped. But I don't think that – I think that offense ran through Joe Burrow, like period. Whereas, and this is going to bring me to my next question, I have two theoreticals for you. I want you to put Kellen Mond in the Alabama offense. Do we talk about him the same way that we're talking about Mac Jones? Is he going in the first round if he played a season, just one season? Never mind, you know, as many seasons as he did at Texas A&M in the Alabama offense.
Right. Do we have the first three seasons at Texas A&M or no?
No. It's Mac Jones. It's like
he has the exact Mac Jones games
or whatever. Yeah, like
the two. Oh yeah, he's the first overall pick.
I think absolutely.
He's the first overall pick by a mile.
Like
we wouldn't even be debating it right now.
Yeah, no. It would be Lawrence came into the season as the chosen one, and now Lawrence would be going two to the Jets, and nobody would blink an eye. Okay. If you have the first three seasons at Texas A&M, now it's a little bit different of a conversation, but I still think he would go first round.
Yeah. Yeah, I think even to Ben's point, even if you had a lot of that questionable film beforehand and then he did this, he would still go in the first round. I think the only like Mond is not going to be as accurate, you know, on the super easy stuff as Jones was, but like he's a heck of a lot better playmaker, I think, than Mac Jones was. And he's still going to be accurate and on time enough to do a lot of the stuff that is basically just right. Gift wrap and a lot in that offense. So, I mean, yeah
a lot of first round. Like my Mond charting is pretty interesting because he's one of these quarterbacks that his catchable rate isn't great, but his actual placement rate, like again, like adjusting for like where coverage guys are, maximizing yards after the catch by hitting guys in stride, when they're running those underneath things, he's pulling his, like you got receivers facing you, so they don't know where the defenders are behind you. He's pulling receivers away from defenders constantly, turning them with the correct shoulder upfield to go. Little thing matters so much, especially when the dude catching is Anaya Smith. Like that's a big deal. So Jones is the opposite. A lot of catchable footballs. Placement at times is making Jalen Waddle break stride. He's got to jump up, or he's got to slow down. He's going across the field, inviting safeties to come down and hit some of those intermediate crossers. There's a real conversation here about like how offenses change the way we perceive accuracy, which we're going way too deep in the weeds here. But with Trey Lance, it's like people think Trey Lance is distinctly inaccurate, and he isn't. It's absurd. Lance's fringe throws get caught by SEC talent. They get caught by Big Ten talent. They don't get adjusted to correctly and caught correctly by FCS talent. Even though North Dakota State's FCS talent is good relatively, it's not good when you measure them up against Power Five. And so that, like that Mon ball placement could have really like been an interesting study in the Alabama offense in a theoretical we'll never ever get to see ever.
I think the North Dakota State stuff you talked about, where the receivers are not FCS level, I think that is, I mean, are not FBS level. I thought the offensive line could definitely handle some FBS team. That's for sure. I mean,
that's the real advantage that he gets.
They have two prospects. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Okay. And then, so my next hypothetical, speaking of North Dakota State, is let's put Trey Lance on the BYU Cougars. Wait, I'm not done. Let's put him on the BYU Cougars. Let's start in 2020. Wait. In 2020, you put him on the BYU Cougars. I think they win as many games as they did. He throws for like the results are a little different in terms of how many rushing yards, how many passing yards compared to Zach Wilson because they're two different quarterbacks. So I think we both agree that they would win a bunch of games. The production would be off the charts if you switch Trey Lance and Zach Wilson. But the question is, 2018 BYU, 2019 BYU. Put Trey Lance in there instead of Zach Wilson when BYU was not looking like the BYU we just saw in 2020. Are they better? Are they worse? Like, where are they with Trey Lance in there as a quarterback?
I don't even know if offensively they become what they became in 2020. Because if you have a player like Lance, you can do, as North Dakota State did, under center wide zone boot action. But you also, you know, they had two legit running backs. They'd be out here running, if they're smart, like 20 personnel pistol. You know what I mean? We'd be, you know, any offense that uses Lance college or pro level is going to be a dual threat heavy offense. And they would use Wilson as like a little sneaky read option keep on third and one. You know what I mean? He had the threat to run off the boot, like DeAndre was talking about. But in general, like he wasn't a big feature part of their running game. You know what I mean? They were giving it to the backs. So I'm not even sure they become the offense they did become in 2020. It would have been beneficial to Lance's development because he would have been playing with a higher caliber of player, a higher caliber of coach. And even though, yes, they would have been running it more with Lance than they did with Wilson, he probably would have attempted more passes than he did with North Dakota State. And that would have just helped his development as a thrower. And so I think it would be to Lance's benefit. I'm not sure we would have seen him in the exact same BYU offense. I love how you're just doing this stuff. This is great to me. This is like when you were a kid and you were like, what if I became like a dwarf, but like I had magic spells. That's like that, like fantasy stuff, but it's seven football.
Well, you know, it's funny. Like the BYU offense became what it was and put Zach Wilson on the map because they were so bad at doing some of the stuff that they would have been good at with Trey Lance. Like you talk about zone read, like they were more of an inside zone team, inside zone RPO team in, I guess, 2018, 2019. And then they started to evolve into that outside zone stuff that you're talking about where you boot. Well, they would have never got there it's such a stupid hypothetical. Well, they would have never got there if Trey Lance was their quarterback because he would have made everything right for them. And you would have been like, well,
exactly.
You're saying, like, we have Trey Lance. We don't need to turn his back. Right. That's the whole thing. We don't need him to boot out and turn his back. We want him facing the defense and reading people and running in vitter veer and zone read and all that stuff.
And I think what's so interesting about the hypothetical actually is that some of what Wilson is so bad at is I think processing in like the 1-5 stuff, like whether it's just regular quick game or like getting down to shallows, like he's very sketchy at. Like he will do that not either not at all or very late. And I think also his management inside the pocket is bad, which was an issue exacerbated in 2019 when they were playing like real defenses and didn't have as good of an offensive line. Mm-hmm. Lance probably solves both of those things because his quick game is probably the best in this class and his pocket management is phenomenal. So he probably would have solved those two things that were kind of ailing the BYU offense in a way. And Wilson was still good at plenty of other stuff that they were not bad, but like, I think he would have fixed the particular things that were plaguing the offense and is still good at a lot of the outside of the pocket stuff that Wilson is good at. He might not be as creative, but his arm is better. He's a significantly better athlete. And I think he still reads the field pretty well outside the pocket, especially on a lot of the design stuff that you've seen him do.
I've done two mega quarterback podcasts with Derek, and at the end of both of them, I just leave going like, I'm too low on Trey Lance. I'm too low on Trey Lance. Dang it, I'm too low on Trey Lance.
I think, Seth, the way you framed the question is actually fascinating because I really do think that if you were to drop Trey Lance into BYU, it would probably do more for BYU than it would do for Trey Lance. What I think about, you know, what I've seen on film from him, you know, as far as his capability, his tools, where I think his ceiling is at, I don't know if any year at BYU, even given this past year where BYU clearly has so much of a talent advantage over basically all of their opponents throughout the season, I don't know if I would say that Trey Lance's draft stock would be any different now than it would be otherwise. You know, I mean, nobody can say that his resume is short on anything. He plays for, you know, FCS Alabama, you know, essentially. And when we're talking about, you know, those degrees and talent and the stratification of talent between the team he plays for and his opponents, it's about the same as looking at, you know, what Mac Jones gets to deal with even against SEC opponents. So what we've seen from him on tape, you know, what we know him to be capable of, where I think that he fits in the NFL. If he had spent time at BYU, I know that we spoke, Seth, like in the group chat when it was kind of being thrown about that maybe he'd transfer up to the FBS level. That was my argument there as well, was I don't know. He would be doing a lot. Say he had gone to LSU, you know, after Joe Burrow leaves. That helps LSU a lot. I don't know if his time at LSU would have helped Trey Lance. Outside of saying, oh, we've just seen him play against the SEC.
Right, it's an NFL hoop. That's right. Let's just jump into that, right?
That's it. I wanted to get into like the actual rankings of the quarterbacks. So let's just start with the consensus number one over player, former five-star recruit, Davis Mills from Stanford. Derek, what are your thoughts on Davis Mills from Stanford?
You had me with that one. I was ready for Lawrence. Derek saw it coming. I didn't. I was just it right in the face.
Let me just say that every podcast since that award show, Seth has been trying to get a Herbert guy moment for somebody else on the podcast.
I respect it.
If that, I'm willing to put myself on the line for that one with Davis Mills. I don't get it. Like every year there is one quarterback, and I think Ben kind of said it at the beginning of the show, where you ask, why do you get into charting? There's one guy a year where I'm like, why did I get into charting? And this year, it was Davis Mills, man. Like, I just don't think he does anything well. And to me, like, this is kind of the case with Mon, but I think Mon is better at some other stuff. And I said this on another podcast, but like, because the Stanford offense does some NFL stuff, it's very easy to be like, oh, well, they do some NFL stuff, so that must mean he can kind of handle it. And I've directly seen this one or two clips, you know, that he can do that'll directly translate. Okay, well, he only does that one out of 10 times and he sucks on the other nine plays. So it's probably not very valuable that he can do it this small amount of times.
Right. He's a, like, he has all of the descriptors of the pocket passer mold. He's got good size, got a good looking release. You know what I mean? He can hitch and you can see him read the field and he'll take a shot in the gut if he needs to. He's tough. He's not accurate. So we've got all the sides for Thanksgiving dinner. We don't have the turkey. You know what I mean? If you're going to be a pocket passer, you got to deliver the ball in a consistent place all over the field. And he doesn't do it. And so it's, the 11 starts will have teams talking themselves into him getting better. And some of his accuracy.
We don't have to talk about Davis Mills. It was a joke question the whole time. Like, you don't have to get into it. If you don't want to get into it.
I have my Davis Mills answer. I've been giving it to everybody. I was ready. Like a politician on the campaign trail, baby.
I think he's so bad that it's actually fun to talk about him. So I was kind of all in on this.
Sorry. Ben, no, please. Davis Mills is,
no, I don't need to. I'm fine. I appreciate you cutting me off.
Yeah. Yeah, Davis Mills is offensive coordinator one in this draft class.
That's a very good way of putting it.
That's where he's headed.
Okay, one more question before we get out of here. When you look at these offenses that are not NFL-like, you know, you just talked about the Stanford offense. Yeah, okay, they run weak side options, so that's an NFL stuff, like whatever. Mm-hmm. When you look at teams that aren't doing that, how do you, when you're looking at projecting, this doesn't even have to do with charting or anything, but how do you look at those offenses that aren't doing a lot of NFL stuff and then project those quarterbacks into an NFL offense?
I mean, to me, a part of it is just like, over time, you're going to get enough of those plays in most offenses that you can get a decent baseline and try to project off of that. It's not going to be as comfortable as you would have, you know, gotten 10 years ago. But I think if you watch a guy's entire full season or last two seasons, you're going to get enough clips, even if they're very scattered around, you're going to get enough of a baseline. But I think to me, like, because overall what we've said with like the in pocket and processing stuff, not being quite as valuable for your immediate success in the NFL, I'm not too pressed about the offense that these guys are playing in, unless you are doing like what UCF does, where it is literally you are just throwing nine balls and it's like a super duper not real offense. If you're in that extreme category, I think it's worrisome. But for what most of these other colleges are doing, you kind of get enough of a baseline and can see enough of them thinking that it's not too worrisome for me if they're not in, like, you know, the Jimbo Fisher offense or, you know, the Stanford offenses of old or whatever.
Yeah, like we brought up the Jamie Newman offense. That's the most challenging one this year, and it's because of how long they hold the mesh point. It's what Derek brought up in terms of like Newman's feet are pointed nowhere. He's got three dudes in his lap. Like, this is just not, like, he's not hitching into anything. In general, right, I think the mental processing concern, which was a big thing a few years ago, is not as much of a concern now, simply because every offense, Shanahan or otherwise, is getting better at simplifying first reads and easing that onboard process. Certainly still matters, and you got to get your third downs, you know what I mean? Like, Derek brought up Trey Lance's third downs. I love Trey Lance's third downs because I was like, all right, everybody knows this is a pass. He's going to actually drop back, and this is going to look like regular, you know? And so you glean what you can from those reps. It's going to continue to bifurcate, which I think it's done over the last few years, into like, on film, you're going through traits, you're going through instincts, you're going through, you know, how's he just operating in play? And then to answer some of those more pedantic questions, you got to put them on the board, you know, especially when it comes to your offense and your terminology and like, oh, you can memorize a play call. Not so much that as saying, we're going to pull film up, ask him why he's making his decisions. We're going to put plays on the board. We're going to put NFL quarterbacks on the board, ask him to describe to us what's happening, see what his process is like. It tells you what he knows, but also tells you how he learns. And then that gives you confidence to say, we can bring him in, we can teach him, we can make him better.
I will say, you know, obviously I don't exist in the charting world really, but for me, when I'm looking at a lot of these offenses and looking at guys trying to project them to the pros, I do think it's important to kind of throw a lot of the context of that offense out, you know, and just focus on what the quarterback is doing on a play-by-play basis. Because a lot of that stuff does not translate. When we talk about RPOs, a lot of the RPO worlds that these college teams can live in by rule cannot exist in the NFL. So you have to throw a lot of those plays out outside of, is it a catchable ball? Did you throw it into a clean window? If it's a tight window throw, what's the quality of the throw, et cetera, you know? From a protection standpoint, how much does a quarterback really understand about protections? Because a lot of these offenses in college basically set the protection and that's it. And anything that goes wrong after that, quarterback, be great, please. Make me look like a good offensive coordinator. You know, from a route concept perspective, you have to think about all the spacing differences that happen with having tighter hashes, you know, the field boundary differences in college versus what it's like in the NFL. So like you said, you know, outside of like that UCF, you know, off the Baylor tree, hyper fast, we're splitting guys out to the sideline hash marks and letting them run nines, you know, all of that stuff you kind of have to throw out because, again, that just cannot be replicated in any way outside of that particular context. You know, teams like the triple, you can find quarterbacks that have tools that are in the triple, but then, you know, a lot of that is going to be projection because, again,
there's this quarterback from Air Force that
trust me, Nate Tice has been blowing up the group chat.
Did Justice pay you?
So, yeah, I mean, you know, again, it's all got to be about just what you're evaluating from a play-by-play basis. And like Ben said, everything other than that is like, we don't have the access to be able to put these guys in front of a whiteboard and say, hey, this concept, you know, you're getting this fire zone, or you're getting this coverage, you're getting this front. Is this even a throw you want to make? Do you know that maybe we want to check into and against this look? Do you know how we're setting a protection against this? You know, are you working your alert? Are you working the middle of the field? Yada, yada, yada. All those types of things obviously is data points that we cannot necessarily access from here. So, you know, it's hard to say, you know, from one offense in college to the NFL that you can draw a point A to point B type of comparison. So it's all got to be what happens in between the whistles.
All right. That's enough. I think we're good here.
Quarterbacking solved.
Yeah, we solved everything that has to do with quarterbacking.
Actually, let me ask one question before we get out of here. It only has to be one name for you guys. You don't have to run through a whole list, but who do you have at the top of 2022? Just off the top of your head.
Yeah.
And why is it future national champion and Heisman winner JT Daniels?
Oh, here it is.
Okay. I'm not yet ready to say, like, I really like JT Daniels, but I remember USC JT Daniels. And when Georgia JT Daniels came out, I was like, this is whatever. And then Georgia JT Daniels was all right. Spencer Rattler right now, I would say, is QB1. Arm talent gets paid. And that boy can throw.
Yeah, it's probably Rattler. It's not Sam Howell, I'll tell you that, but it's probably Rattler.
Thank you. Say that again so Seth remembers it, because I don't want to hear this all year.
I think with Howell, you know, they tried to make him a real quarterback.
Seth, we don't have to talk about Sam Howell as a joke. Hello.
All right. Tell the people, Derek, tell the people where they can find you.
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at QBClass, QBKLASS. You can find some college football stuff over at NBC Sports Edge, and I do NFL and college football draft stuff at Football Outsiders.
Yeah, I'm at the Draft Network on Twitter at Benjamin Solak, Solak, S-O-L-A-K. Draft stuff to the Draft Network, podcast Locked on NFL Draft, then all the Eagle stuff lives at Bleeding Green Nation. Go Birds.
All right, thank you guys for joining the podcast. All right, there it is. PFF College Football Podcast with Deontay Lee, Seth Galina, Benjamin Solak, and Derek Klassen. Talking quarterbacks, man. Talking quarterbacks. All right, next week we're doing it. Me and Anthony Chesh, me and PFF Tony, he's back on the podcast. We are doing a live mock draft. I believe that it's going to be Monday at 4 Eastern. So, check that out. It's going to be on YouTube, and then on the podcast you'll get it when you normally listen to this podcast. All right, thank you. See you guys next week. Bye.